Oral questions by members.
Opposition House Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, when the Premier put his political ambition ahead of public health and then tried to camouflage it by throwing his partners with the Green Party under the bus, he said, and I quote, "We took steps this summer to address the challenges that families faced when it comes to the scourge of opioids, and we were rebuffed by our colleagues in our so-called stable administration." Well, Mr. Speaker, the Premier may have thrown the Greens under the bus, but he was all words with no action or follow-through based on his quote. It is now 8 months later, and there is still no action. Last week, Vancouver Island saw the death of two children, one just 12 years old. They didn't get the help they needed. Can the Premier tell those parents why, after using it as a political excuse, he has taken no more action on helping families?
Minister of Mental Health and Addictions.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you to the member for the question. The death of a child is a tragedy that no family should have to face. My heart goes out to them. We've been working hard to build up the system of voluntary supports and have added services in so many areas in response to the families that have told me and told colleagues that how hard it has been to access service. Despite the number of new supports built in, young people still fall through the cracks. And for that, I grieve along with the peers and friends and family that have lost young ones. The approach that we've taken, although understanding absolutely that there are parents who still who do believe, and I agree with them, that stabilization care might have made a difference in the lives of their children. The focus that I have as minister right now is on building up that system of voluntary care. That will work to save lives right now, and it will also facilitate the complex conversations that are ahead of us as we readdress legislation to stabilize young people after an overdose and work to connect them with care before they're discharged.
Opposition House Leader on a supplemental.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, let's be clear, that 12-year-old was seven when this Premier took over the reins of government. It's been 5 years. The Premier thought that Bill 22 and protecting children was important enough to plunge BC into an election and put the government on hold for 2 months in the middle of a pandemic, even though Bill 22 was widely panned by many. He insisted this was the reason that he had to go to an election. Well, this pandemic is one public health crisis. The opioid crisis is another one, and it's been going on for that 5 years. The Premier's words are cold comfort to the families. And here's another quote from the Premier, though. "I believe this is an important bill because I've talked to parents who've lost children. They wanted government to do something so there was at least a legacy for the loss of a loved one." So once again, Mr. Speaker, here we are 8 months later. There is no new legislation, none on the horizon. It seems like the Premier was only worried about his legacy 8 months ago, not bringing forward legislation in a meaningful way. So again, to the Premier, when will the Premier be introducing a new bill that helps parents and families?
Minister of Mental Health and Addictions.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Again, my thoughts are with the family and the friends of the two young women who lost their lives this month, and many more, over 1,700 people that have lost their lives to toxic drug supply in this year of the pandemic is heartbreaking. Our work to expand the system of care has been going on the last few years, and it continues. The unprecedented investment announced this past month by the finance minister, $500 million to build up that mental health and addictions response, is work that carries on the, again, unprecedented investment. There is so much more work to do. And yet, to have just already almost $100 million of this budget dedicated particularly towards supports for children and families, to be doubling youth treatment and recovery beds, unprecedented in British Columbia's history, to be training up new healthcare support mental health workers in many of our universities and post-secondary institutions, to have added to new school districts the integrated child and youth teams trying to get ahead of problems, trying to address problems while they're still small before they build into a crisis. This is work that we're doing across the continuum of care, building up those voluntary supports, which will give a different flavor to the public consultations and work around stabilization care legislation, work that is ahead of us, but our focus right now is on building up voluntary care.
Member for Surrey White Rock.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And that answer is little comfort to this 12-year-old's family, and that answer is too late for this 12-year-old's family and for this 12-year-old. Ali Thomas overdosed three times before and ended up at Victoria General Hospital. The fourth time, as we know, was fatal. As her family was looking for help, Ali fell through the cracks, and as the minister just put it moments ago, our youth are falling through the cracks. Those are the words of the minister in this house today. Sorry, I'm being heckled by the Attorney General. Will I ask about the death of a 12-year-old? Be respectful.
Members, let's listen to the question, please. Please continue.
Sorry, I think the death of a 12-year-old is serious.
Please continue, member.
As Ali's mom put it, if I was able to be there for her, if I had the help and she had the help, I think she would be here right now. The Premier justified a pandemic election that put government on pause by saying he needed a majority to help families like Ali's. So my question to the Premier today is, where is that help for Ali's family?
Minister of Mental Health and Addictions.
Minister. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We've heard from families who lost children to overdose, who believe that better care after an overdose would have saved their child. Our government agrees, which is why we are trying to build up the mental health and addictions response system for young people across the entire continuum of care. That young people still fall through the cracks is a tragedy, something that that weighs on every person, of course, on the front line, every peer, every friend. It's a heartbreaking loss for someone so young. And again, I extend my condolences to the family and friends of the two young women on Vancouver Island who died to overdose this month. We remain as a government deeply committed to building up that system of care, to preventing loss of life, to drug toxicity, to tackling addiction and mental health problems while they are still small problems, building up, doubling the number of youth treatment beds, working to build up better post-overdose connection to care. That's what last summer's legislation was intended to do. We did hear that building up voluntary, getting the voluntary care built up and on the ground is an important companion to that legislation. And that is the work that we're doing right now. I appreciate the members' support for both building up more services and for a legislated solution. And they must work together, and that is the work that we're determined to do.
Member for Surrey White Rock on supplemental.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And when this story broke, the minister and the premier both said they couldn't respond due to privacy. But let's give them the facts. A 12-year-old has lost their life. She overdosed four times, and she did not get the help she needed. I've got two 12-year-olds in my house, and you can smirk all you want. But at the end of the day, when we are talking about the death of our youth, and we are talking about legislation that this premier promised to bring in and then used as an excuse to head us into an election, I think British Columbians, I think our youth, I think the families of those who have lost their loved ones deserve better than what this government has given them. My question to the Premier is this. Where is the legislation that he promised to deliver in the summer? It's 8 months later, and our families can no longer wait.
Minister of Mental Health and Addictions.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The death of a child in these circumstances is something
Member,
that...
Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I proceed?
Minister will continue.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The death of a child in circumstances like this is something that the coroner will investigate. I look forward very much to the advice of the coroner and that of the representative of children and youth. We want to know from the analysis that we'll receive from them whether stabilization care would have helped in this to prevent these two deaths. I'm hungry for that advice and that information, but we also want to learn as much as we can about what services were offered and how it is that young people still continue to fall through the cracks, despite the number of new supports that we have added in the time that we have had in government, and whether the investments that we have planned ahead are going to be adequate to continue to respond to the increased toxicity that's been caused by the in drugs caused by the pandemic, but also the intense pressure that young people are on and the mental health supports. We're working as hard as we can to build up those supports, to build up that system of care, to save lives. And we will learn every lesson that we can from the loss of these two young lives. And we will honor the process that the coroner and the representative for children and youth have laid out for us to do that with respect and do everything we can as a government to prevent further loss of life.
Member for Sandwich North and Islands.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The results from a University of British Columbia trial of rapid testing in first-year residences has come back with positive results, positive cases, and positive findings. 25 PCR-confirmed cases were caught in this trial, stopping further transmission from spreading from highly infectious yet asymptomatic people. The trial's results noted that students preferred to test themselves when given the option and effectively decreased the spread of COVID-19 due to great engagement. The study from UBC shows success using rapid tests in communal settings and that people are wanting agency in what they can do to bend the curve. Directives to stay home and stay safe are passive and have exhausted people. Rapid tests are a tool of engagement. They give people something to do. They give people an action and an active role to play in our pandemic response. My question through you, Honourable Speaker, is to the Minister of Health. Will this government be using the results of this study to implement a revised rapid testing strategy in British Columbia?
Minister of Health.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the member for his question. I would start by disagreeing somewhat. I think that there is a role for all British Columbians, and British Columbians have done an excellent job in following public health guidance, engaging with one another on it, and following public health orders. And you've seen that repeatedly as case counts have gone up and then come down because of the actions of British Columbians. With respect to rapid testing, our policy is directed by our scientific experts at the BCCDC, the provincial health officer. We laid out that policy in detail on March the 3rd. Dr. Bonnie Henry did on behalf of the province, and that allows for an increased use of rapid testing. Some of the technology that the member is talking about is very recent. Here in British Columbia. Some of the technology that's been used in other jurisdictions isn't yet licensed in Canada, but absolutely the idea of responding to this pandemic is to adapt and adapt again. And so all studies that are put in place on the issue of rapid testing are reviewed by both the BCCDC and the provincial health officer, and they'll be used to guide policy in the days to come.
Member for Saanich North and Islands on a supplemental.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you to the Minister for the response. A Government of Canada news release from the Health Canada just a couple of days ago talks about testing and screening as important tools to help reduce the risk of outbreaks quickly, to identify and isolate cases and limit spreading in workplaces and in the community. It goes on to say, across the country, rapid tests have already helped to identify and stop the transmission over 11,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. The reluctance of this BC NDP government to remove barriers to rapid testing is frankly astonishing. They did finally change the restrictions to allow non-medical professionals to administer rapid tests in the workplace, yet as of last week, 33 workplaces have applied for these point-of-care tests and zero have been approved. British Columbia is falling behind on rapid testing in the workplace. We've used 1% of the rapid tests in our stockpile, with more than a million of these tests set to expire this fall. The Federal Industry Advisory Panel has called for rapid tests in workplace and said that BC is dragging its heels. My question, Honourable Speaker, is again to the Minister of Health. Why has this government created barriers to access rapid tests in the midst of this pandemic?
Minister of Health.
Speaker, I'm really surprised that the member on this precise point of how to use testing, that surely amongst all subjects should be guided by scientific experts and is in British Columbia, suddenly becomes a partisan issue. It's not a partisan issue. Our policy is guided by the Canadian Committee, and we've heard regularly from Dr. Dalla and Sue Paish, who will be familiar with members of the House, who are chairing the federal committee, and by Dr. Bonnie Henry and the BC CDC. Our policy around rapid testing was based first on validating the tests, which was important, then doing a series of pilot projects, then setting out a policy, and now using them more and more as the technology evolves. And that is based on the scientific evidence. It's not a trade agreement where one political party has one position and another has another position. We are being guided by Dr. Bonnie Henry, by the BC CDC, by federal advice, and by the scientific evidence. And that will continue to be the case in the coming days and weeks of this pandemic.
Member for Kelowna West.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, tenants of subsidized housing in BC were shocked to learn that they did not qualify for the rent freeze under this government. The BC housing notice tenants received says, quote, the government of BC rent freeze does not apply to rent geared to income. Why is the Premier raising rent on people in subsidized housing in the middle of a pandemic?
Attorney General.
So rent geared to income is exactly as it is described. You pay the rent that you can afford according to your income. The reason why there's not a rent freeze required for that group is because it's directly tied to the tenant's income. So if you've lost all of your income because of COVID, then your rent goes down accordingly. If your income has gone up despite COVID, you pay your rent accordingly. It's a very carefully tailored mechanism. And to be blunt, Honorable Speaker, the entirety of people living in supportive housing are paying well below market rent. It's supportive, affordable housing geared to the individual person's income.
Member for Kelowna West on a supplemental.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think that when it comes to the pandemic issues, that answer is a bit insensitive. The fact is that these people are still renters. They're still paying to BC Housing a rent. The Premier is the only landlord in the province who gets a raise in rent this year. He's exempted his government from his own rent freeze rules, and the tenants who need it most are the ones who pay. Why is the Premier playing by a different set of rules and charging BC housing tenants with rent increases? Or is this just another botched NDP plan?
Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I guess I would take the member's concern more seriously if he hadn't just been on the radio advocating against free cell phones for low-income people. Let me read the quote. He says he's on the side of the people in supportive housing. Oh, that's interesting. He blamed the fact that TELUS is providing free cell phones He said, so frankly, the reason that homeless people are coming, first of all, he said homeless people are coming to British Columbia from across Canada. And the reason is, quote, because it's the best option in Canada in a lot of cases because the government has, quote, even provided cell phones, unquote. So the member,
members,
the members on the radio advocating against low-cost cell phones for people who are homeless or at risk of homelessness. And then in this question period, he says rent geared to income is somehow unfair to people when it's actually geared to their actual income. The member needs to get his story straight. Whose side is he on, Honourable Speaker?
Member for Kamloops, South Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Tri-Branch Housing Co-op is home to 220 tenants in Coquitlam, all of whom are seniors and low-income earners. These residents were shocked to learn recently that their lease will not be renewed next year. It will expire. They have written to the Premier to ask the Premier, to urge the Premier to purchase the land so that these folks can retain their affordable co-op housing units. President of Tri-Branch, Dave Pilipau says, and I quote, we're in a panic. This is home to many, many people for four decades, end quote. Interestingly enough, Tri-Branch is located in the riding of the MLA for Coquitlam Burke Mountain. He's nowhere on this issue. This co-op is literally in the backyard of the former housing minister and the current finance minister. She's also missing in action on this file. So the question is this, will the Premier step up and will he save these hundreds of affordable co-op homes in Coquitlam?
Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an issue we're dealing with across the province. There are a number of co-ops that were established by the federal government when they used to support co-op housing. They don't anymore. That are on leases that are expiring. South Falls Creek in Vancouver is another example. There's a very large co-op in Burnaby. And I appreciate the member drawing this to my attention. Of course, I've heard about it from local members as well. And BC Housing continues to work with co-ops that are in distress like that. And I'll make sure that they are working on that. I thank the member for raising that important issue.
Member for Kamloops, South Thompson, on a supplemental.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, we know why the government won't step in to protect these homes. The answer is because the developer evicting them is the International Union of Operating Engineers Pension Fund. The Cooperative Housing Federation VC President Tom Armstrong says, and I quote, now the union pension funds trustees say to themselves, we have to get a market return on the value of our property, end quote. Mr. Speaker, the IUOE just happens to be the same union that's donated over $590,000 to the NDP. Just happens to be one of the NDP's 19 handpicked unions that are benefiting at taxpayers' expense from the NDP's discriminatory union-only mandate on major infrastructure projects. So again, the question to the Premier is this. Why is the Premier throwing 220 British Columbians, mostly seniors and those on low incomes, why is he throwing them out of their homes in this affordable housing co-op to reward the NDP's union donors?
Attorney General.
Well, let's be frank, Honourable Speaker. If we had already purchased the building, the member would be standing up saying that we purchased it to favour the union. If we didn't, we're not purchasing it to favour the union. There's no win here, but I can tell the member, if he's legitimately concerned about the tenants in the building, that BC Housing is working with the union to have negotiations about an appropriate price based on appraisals. That conversation is ongoing, and I'm well aware of the issue, and we are concerned about the tenants in the building. The vital issue to us is protecting the tenants and making sure that they are looked after, and that is definitely a priority. I thank the member for raising the issue and for his encouragement to buy the building.
Member for Abbotsford West.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. For over 15 years, the BC School Fruit and Vegetable Nutritional Program has been creating an exciting direct link between students in the classroom and farmers. Today, over 500,000 students in over 1,400 schools right across British Columbia receive regular shipments in public schools, in First Nation schools. They receive regular shipments of fresh fruit, vegetables, and milk. It's been a tremendous success until now. And why do I say that? I say that because unbelievably for me, and I think many others, the small society that runs the school fruit and vegetable program has been told that the government funding that they have been receiving for over a decade that allows them to provide fresh fruit, vegetables, and milk is ending and won't be continued. My question is to the Agriculture Minister. Can she please explain why her government is eliminating funding for a program that has provided 500,000 students with fresh BC fruits, vegetables, and milk?
Minister of Agriculture.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for the question. The fruit and vegetable program is something that has been very valuable, and we have worked with the association for a number of years. The funding for the fruit and vegetable program comes from the Ministry of Health, we have had discussions on how to find ways to support this incredible association. Thank you.
Minister of, member for Episode West.
Well, that might be the first example of passing the non-existent buck that I've seen in this House. Look, I'm troubled that the minister continues to speak in the past tense about a program that has been such an incredible success, that has been funded by previous governments, by this government, until now. Here's what people say about this. This is from the Chillow School on Mile 293 Alaska Highway, from someone that's worked there for 6 years. I can tell you with 100% honesty that the vegetables that we receive at the school are the only vegetables that some of our students get. I got a handful of letters from Quadra Island, from Merritt, from Big Lake Elementary, from Clinton, from a Cole Martha Curry in Surrey, from right across British Columbia, Mr. Speaker, touting the benefits of this program. And all of this costs between $3 and $4 million. It's roughly the same amount that the Premier's office budget is going up, Mr. Speaker. Society is now at their wits' end, and I hope the minister will take account of this. Without the funding commitment from government now, they cannot plan to operate into next year, into the next school year. They'll have to notify the 1,000 farmers that their products aren't going to be required. They're going to have to notify the 4,000 volunteers that help distribute the products to students that their help is no longer required. The merits of this program speak for themselves. Will the minister stand in this House today and confirm that the funding that has kept this program alive and made it such a success won't be ended, but will continue? Give the kids their milk money, Mr.
Minister of Agriculture.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you again for the question and for highlighting an amazing program that has been operating for a number of years, bringing fruits and vegetables and milk to schools around British Columbia. We will be looking at ways on how to support this type of program. I'll be having discussions with the Minister of Health and the Association in the near future, but the member is correct. In some cases, this is the only fresh produce or fruit that schools receive, especially in our northern communities. But we'll be working within the Ministry of Agriculture, within our Feed BC program, to look at ways to support more fruit and vegetables that are grown and processed in BC to be distributed in BC throughout all of our major institutions, including health. Thank you.
Member for Delta South.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, Mr. Speaker, I personally am happy to say I've been very involved over the years with BC Agriculture in the classroom. I've worked with Ms. Pat Ton on this project, which 98% of teachers in BC have told us how important it is for this program to continue with children in schools getting milk, vegetables, and fruit, and going home and telling their parents how important it is for them to continue to eat those products as they grow older. The BC School Fruit and Vegetable Nutritional Program, Mr. Speaker, has been seeking funding since February. On March 22nd, they met with the Minister of Agriculture. In April, they emailed her saying, and I quote, "Will the program be government-funded or is it no longer supported? The answer is required by May the 10th, which was yesterday, Mr. Speaker, in order to prepare plans and order BC products," end quote. But the budget came and the deadline passed yesterday with no funding for the program, no money for fresh vegetables in the classroom, yet $4 million for more spin doctors in the Premier's office. Mr. Speaker, why did the Premier find the money for spin doctors in his office, but not for BC fruit, vegetables, and milk for children in classrooms?
Minister of Health. No, sorry, Minister of Agriculture.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you to the member for the question. Again, highlighting a program that is very valuable and is something that many schools in many parts of British Columbia depend on. We will be working together with the Association and the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Education to look at how our program can continue. We know that the earlier that children get a taste of fresh British Columbia produce in their lives, the more chance that they will have to be healthy eaters. And so this is something that I'm very interested in. I know the Minister of Health is and the Minister of Education, and we will be working together to find a way to distribute this amazing produce around the province. Thank you.
The bell ends the question period.